All right, welcome back to Film Shake. This is episode 6.5. I'm Jordan.
This is Nick.
And here we are to talk about the spoilers for Good Morning or Ohio. So, Ohio to you, Nick. It's good to have you back and talk about another Ozu film. Late Spring was your first, and I think Good Morning is now my third or fourth Ozu, so still kind of diving into his filmography. So we talked a lot about farts on the previous episode. We talked about how this film coming off of Late Spring wasn't quite your thing.
But what we really talked about in the first show was farts, but there's something, you know, really, which is the natural evolution of farts that the movie also explores that we didn't get into.
The natural evolution?
Yes, of a fart that sharts. There's a kid in this movie that wants to be one of the cool kids.
He fart on command.
That's right. Just like the cool brothers in this movie do, the ones who want the television to go on the silent strike. He wants to fart on command so badly. You know, his mom also isn't cool. You know, she's always gossiping and nobody likes her.
Yes.
And she's also produced a good-for-nothing son who just can't fart like all the other boys.
Which I wonder if that's what Grandma was saying when she said, oh, you produced a son like that.
That's
a
right.
Son who can't fart on command.
That's right.
I don't think that's what she had in mind. But yeah, he's obviously lacking in some areas.
That's right. So something that we save for now to talk about is that not only is this film full of farts, it's bookended by a massive sharting
yes.
by this poor loser kid who wants to be like the cool kids but can't be because when he tries to fart, poo comes out.
See, it's a hilarious movie.
I think I'm going to bump my score up from a 7 to an 8 now. I totally forgot about that scene.
Oh, yeah.
So that's the bookend for the film. Actually, as gross as that just sounded, it's actually kind of a charming bookend for the movie just
yes.
because of how idyllic the whole scene is. You know, it's just a part of this silly town here, this silly suburb in Tokyo. You know, these
right.
kids are running off to school and, you know, the goofy kid's back home waiting for his mom to wash his underwear
yeah.
so he can rejoin his friends that he's just not quite as cool as.
I love how she tells him, just don't wear any underwear for a while, because he keeps crapping his pants.
She's such a witch, that mom.
We get that great last shot that mirrors the very first shot of the film. You know, we open up with the electrical towers, like right in front of us in the foreground, and in the background you have the Tokyo suburb, and we kind of cut and get closer and closer to that and eventually go inside the houses with the families. And then the very end, after the mom tells the crapping kid to...
which is all I can think about.
I don't know his name. I think maybe it was Ko or something.
Pooping kid.
Pooping boy. It sounds like... Yeah. Anyway, after he tells him not to wear any underwear, and he's just kind of standing there in his shirt, like scratching his butt, and he's just kind of like embarrassed, we get this great shot at the end of all the clothesline with all the underwear hung up on the clothesline out to dry, and you have the electrical towers in the background, so it's kind of like a mirrored reverse shot from the very beginning. But what's interesting studying about Ozu is his clothesline shots are famous. He actually has multiple clothesline shots in various films. I mean, there are some in Late Spring that we watched too, I believe. And so here, it's almost like Ozu's making this comment about himself and this movie and all his other films. Like, here's a clothesline shot, like those beautiful pillow shots, those poetic shots you like to see in my other films. But here I'm going to undercut it with this theme of sharting and underwear and just put a spin on it a little bit of, I've got this idyllic moment with the clothesline, but it's full of underwear. You know, it's full of poop. So this, it's just, Ozu just having a great time playing around with his own filmography, which is great.
You know what Friedrich Nietzsche said?
There's no God. God is dead.
He actually... There was an evolution of ideas that actually sprung from this original idea, which was, show me a man's clothesline, and you've shown me the man.
Ah.
He really said that.
So what is Ozu saying about himself? His clothesline has become all but underwear. And really, it's just a fun shot because you just see how much underwear this mom's got to wash But hey, she's got an awesome new washing machine. So sorry, I kind of just totally derailed from your evolution thought there. But what point were you trying to make there?
I was just making up a fake Nietzsche quote. But now that I think about it.
Was that fake?
Yeah, he didn't really say that. Okay. But
I was duped.
Now that I say it, right, she's the one who really needs the washing machine more than anyone. And this washing machine creates so many misunderstandings in the town. But yes. Really, all of the town's problems come down to this sharding kid.
That's because true. That's the spoiler.
That's right. No one would think that she's stolen the money if she didn't get this washing machine. And she only got the washing machine because the damn kid won't stop sharding his pants. It's all his fault.
And see, that's just the brilliance of Ozu, how he weaves all this together and the complexity of the plot. Even though it's so simple and so ridiculous and frivolous, it's somehow he just wraps it all together and it's all interconnected. It's a wonderful film. I loved it.
I'm liking it more and more the more we talk about it.
Yeah, you're just making me like it even more. Well, let's move on to our Eye of the Duck, where we talk about the key scene of the film. So I believe yours comes before mine.
That's right. So
I'll let you go first.
We talked about a scene late in the film where the two boys who are the central characters of the film, who really I wanted to see more of, but they are still really the central characters.
Right.
They want a television set. Their parents won't buy them the set, so they go on a strike. They stop talking. They become silent. And they're finally just fed up with these darn grown-ups. And they've decided they're going to just run off with a rice cooker, and they're just going to be fine on their own, eating their parents' rice out in this little patch of grass by this little levee by the water. And it just, you know, it just brings to mind any time, I don't know, maybe my childhood was different, but I think all kids at some point, you kind of band together with whatever other children are close by, and you kind of make your own little society, whether it's, you know, a treehouse, a clubhouse,
right,
wherever else, you know, someone's attic. If you don't live in South Louisiana and your attic isn't, you know, a giant death trap.
Yeah.
It's kind of
like making your own space when you're a kid. You
exactly.
Know, creating that little magical world.
Yes. And we discussed this in the non-spoiler show, but it is really one of the few times that he just kind of pulls back and just gives you a shot that doesn't have this rectangularism where it's just very free, open, peaceful.
Yeah.
I just really wanted to be there. It made me very nostalgic. I wanted to be just out on the green, you know, with my childhood friends or with my siblings. And it really kind of just brings to mind the simplicity that maybe is really what all these characters want or need, you know, which is at the root of all these miscommunications and all these good morning and nice weather and pretty clouds today, things that they're all saying that don't mean anything. What really does mean something is the simple connection of moments like this, which of course is immediately interrupted by the neighborhood policeman.
And the misunderstandings again between
that's right.
the little boy and, oh, I stole the rice, so we need to run away. There's a policeman.
Even though it's their family's rice cooker,
which is
technically their property.
Which I wanted to bring up, too, a reason why they have to take the food and run away is because they've been silent throughout other parts of the film. They weren't able to ask for their lunch money. They had to go hungry because of the silent strike, so it had an interesting turn there. And I think at this point, it was like, well, we can't ask anybody to feed us or to give us rice. Let's just steal it and run away with it. So I think that's a part of the plot there, too, is the silent strike just affecting their day-to-day and how they have to kind of maneuver and do things a little differently, which is again, part of that that magical aspect of childhood, which is like kind of going outside of the boundaries and exploring this simple and very, you know, just like non-threatening, non-dramatic exploration outside of the suburb and the boundary that they're usually put in. But it just makes it for a really nice, quiet, fun little outing with these kids. And I think the key dialogue there is where one of the little boy is having to scoop the rice with his hand, and he's eating it out of his hand. He's like, isn't this messy? And the other little boy is like, yes, isn't it fun? So, you know, I guess just goes back to that innocence of childhood and enjoying things that are a little messy and that are outside of the norm. But I think that's what these people need. You know, they're so closed in by all these boundaries and this proximity of everybody just shoved all together in these suburban houses. They need to get outside and live a little bit and free themselves from those boundaries.
That's right. And something that you and I were discussing, something I like with Late Spring was how it didn't feel like Ozu picked a perspective. He kind of just presented to you a situation and you kind of had to make up your own mind as to if decisions were right or wrong, what was morally correct or what wasn't. But with this, it really did feel like he was saying, this perspective is my ideal.
The boy's perspective?
What they're doing right now, this is as things should be.
Right. Especially in that moment. I think later I'll bring that question up again about, in my Eye of the Duck scene, I'm going to go with the moment when the boys come home from being lost, and then we get that great shot of the TV finally in its box sitting in the hallway.
Yes, they've been on the run from the police this whole time.
right. And they've been on this silent strike, and the parents have refused to buy them the TV. The dad has even said at a bar or at a restaurant at one point discussing television that he fears it'll make millions of Japanese idiots. But through a course of events, they buy a TV. You could argue because of their neighbor. Their neighbor is down on his luck. He's the drunk that stumbles in and out of their house because it's so much like his. He's confused. But he finally gets a job as a salesman, and he talks them into honoring his new job by purchasing something from him. And that's earlier in the film. Then finally we get back to the house and the boys discover, okay, they bought a TV, and nothing is said between the kids and the parents. I'm guessing the kids are just assuming, oh, our silent protest worked. They finally, you know, caved in and bought us a TV. And you could argue, yeah, they really did. They didn't have to buy a TV from the salesman, but it was kind of like kill two birds with one stone, maybe. And it really shows that the boys are the ones that have the power in this family. They are calling all the shots. Yeah. You know, they are pushing the family around to do whatever they want, pretty much. And they're not really held in check at any moment.
No, not at all.
They just kind of go around and do whatever they want. But I love how Ozu punctuates the scene. You could see the kids as a little bratish at times. They're definitely insolent and rebellious.
Mm-hmm.
And they could come off as one note as, you know, again, maybe Ozu, in a lesser film, you would say, oh, the filmmaker is kind of moralizing and showing us the insolence of children and how they should obey their parents. But we really don't get any commentary here. You kind of expect it. It's kind of set up a little bit like, oh, what's the ending going to be? How's he going to wrap this up? But I love that Ozu punctuates this scene with a moment between the boys and their dad. And the dad is, you know, the kids are all exuberant. They're all happy that they finally got this TV. They break their silent strike and they go into just cheering. And then the dad comes in and again says, you're being too noisy. You need to quiet down or I'm going to take it back. And the great moment where Isamu, the little boy, says, no, look at his face. He's lying. I can tell. He's smiling. He doesn't mean it. And the dad, played brilliantly by Chizu Ryu, who was also, he's a Ozu regular. He was the dad in Late Spring.
Yes.
But he puts on this tough dad, you know, authoritarian voice. I'm the dad. He's like, oh, and he gives him this deep frown. And then he walks away. He really doesn't do anything to come back at the kid for saying that.
He's completely impotent in the situation.
He's completely impotent. The kids have all the power. They've gotten what they want. And they're reading right through the lies and the pleasantries and the meaningless talk of the grown-ups, right? It goes back to that where he's saying, I'm going to take it away. But you know he's not going to take it away. They're going to have the TV. And the next day they leave and they say, make sure that they're going off to school. And they say, make sure you have the TV ready when we get home. So they're just ordering the parents around, telling them whatever they want to do.
Get this thing set up.
Right. But yeah, the insolence of the children is very apparent throughout, and they're tolerated, and they're really just allowed to do whatever they like. You know, this does kind of contrast the silent feature that we talked about earlier in the other show. This film, Good Morning, is kind of based or a reworking, you could say, of I Was Born, but it has a lot of similar themes. the dad there is really the authority of the house in that, you know, pre-war Japan. Here we have this westernized post-war Japan, and the dad has really lost all his authority in the house. And I think there's a very subtle, very gentle commentary going on there about westernization,
mm-hmm.
you know, and this the ideal authoritarian dad
yes.
has just really, like you said, become impotent and lost mm-hmm. all his power. And that has a lot to do with modernity in the conveniences like TV.
Yes, that's something we didn't really get into. But again, I don't really feel qualified to get into it because there were things like that in Late Spring too, like with the Coca-Cola and with the sign, the American sign by the bridge about, you know, the weight and them riding over it with the little bicycles and the giant American truck rolling over it.
Right.
All that stuff that has no context in what we're talking about now, and my apologies, but all that to say, yes, I definitely, we all, I think in America, especially people in our age range or around our age range, but, you know, we kind of have this idyllic image, you know, of this kind of space age, we just got all these new appliances, everything's shiny, you know, wife in this shiny yellow dress, smiling, holding up a Coke bottle.
Right.
Husband walking in the door, smiling with a briefcase and a suit and tie.
Yeah.
You know, like smiling kids tugging at their clothes, you know. And those are the people who just A-bombed Japan, you know,
yeah.
5 years before. That looks a little different. You know, you're going to be skeptical of those people bringing that lifestyle into your country.
Definitely.
So,
I mean, yeah.
We can't even imagine that. They're the only country that's ever been attacked by those weapons. We can't even put that into perspective. You know, no matter how empathetic you are, you can't put yourself in those shoes.
Yeah, and a lot of the westernization also is, you know, a lot of the Western values the Japanese felt like was kind of foisted upon them after the war, you know, with mm-hmm. the American occupation. And I believe it was in 48 or 49 where the Americans pretty much wrote them a constitution and, you know, allowed for women to divorce their husbands and mm-hmm. different things like that. Studying up on watching the commentary on Late Spring brought a lot of that out for me. But yeah, here you could definitely see that same kind of gentle critique or sideways look at that westernization that, you know, that it buckles against this very traditional Japanese culture and the kind of contrast and conflict between that. But again, with Ozu, do we really get an outright, you know, like indictment of that? I don't feel that so much. But there's definitely this idea of like the deteriorating traditional values and culture due to modernization. Like I wrote here, just like appliances make it easier on our way of life, the social pleasantries help us get along, but ultimately leave us unable to truly connect or say meaningful things. So
that's deep, man.
Again, getting out there in the wild, so to speak, and having that rice cooker out there on the levee and just digging in with your hands, like
getting messy.
That's the more meaningful time there. That's the like building block of childhood.
Yeah. I mean, you know, whenever you're like stirring a pot, you know, with a spoon in your hands, you're building muscles in your arms.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're just pushing a button and getting a machine to do it,
I definitely think, yeah,
muscles are growing flaccid.
There's some skepticism there of appliances and how, yeah, they take away that meaning and, you know, that actual experience.
Man, now you're making me think this movie's deep again.
It's so deep, man. You got to see it. You got to get into it. I don't know. But I love ultimately how Ozu doesn't patronize the children. I think that's the biggest thing for me is watching this. He doesn't, as a lot of films do, just take children and put them saying things that adults would say or acting mm-hmm. like grown-ups. He really captures that true sense of childhood, and he doesn't idealize them. You know, he brings it out in a true light. They have a lot of flaws, of course, and a lot of the characters in this have flaws, but ultimately, you know, they're just real. They're just lively and fun and vivacious characters that I really connected with and enjoyed watching. I really love this film. I gave it 5 out of 5. It's just kind of near and dear to my heart now. I'm going to keep watching this and keep loving it and get more out of it every time, I hope. So.
And I just thought it was okay. I enjoyed the farts and sharts, and I gave it a 7 out of 10, but as we talk about it, I'm like, maybe there's more than farts.
Maybe there's more than some farts and sharts there.
I don't know. Maybe I'll have to come back to it at another point.
Well, I hope you will, and I hope everybody will come back and listen to our next series now that we've wrapped up the Japanese Masters. Hope you enjoyed the show. We'll see you next time for more Film Shake.
Take it easy. We'll get our highly paid fact checking team to go look this up for us.
Yeah.